When I was 16, my family moved from Houston, Texas, where I had grown up, to Morristown, New Jersey, which is in the middle of the northern half of the state. From an early age, I had taken art lessons and art classes and so forth. And so when I got to New Jersey and I was going into my high school years, I was really interested in working in more three-dimensional art, carving stone and wood. And there was a community arts organization that had an art studio. It was about four or five blocks from our home. So I signed up for a Tuesday evening sculpting class. Alan, the teacher, was gaunt, always had worn clothes and a scruffy beard and hair. His eyes were quite intense, but his... His personality was quite intense, but his eyes were kind and his voice was soft. And to me, he was sort of the epitome of the Greenwich Village, you know, artist who lived in the city and took this commuter train out to the suburbs in the evening to earn a little bit of money to support his real passion, art. And I liked Alan immediately. For one thing, you know, as a cautious teenager, kind of stumbling around, he treated me like an adult rather than this cautious kid that I needed. And he always spoke to me, you know, in a way that was very respectful, very candid, you know, very straightforward and kind. And it was as if he just knew there was a fully developed artist inside me, and he was going to talk to him and just to heck with the rest of it. And I ended up learning a lot of things from him. And so as I was putting my notes together for this talk tonight, I kept on thinking the things, I kept on coming back to the things that I had learned from him and realized how much those actually apply to meditation as well. So I thought it might be kind of fun to just look at the art of meditation through this lens. We'll see what happens with it. Tomorrow night, I want to walk us through all the jhanas in some detail, which will take a little while. But I wanted to talk about this tonight is to kind of set the overall frame, both for a kind of way of looking at the jhanas themselves as well as the as well as meditation as an art. One thing that he taught me right from the very beginning was how to really pay attention to the whole of the art I was working on in a very balanced way. He said right away, you know, when I started carving, he wanted me to block the whole thing out, not just part of it, block out the whole piece I was making, and then I could do a refined blocking and then roughly work on the details and then refine the details. But he didn't want me polishing and finishing one side while the other was still in a rough condition. He put me in a small art studio inside this larger studio because my hammer and chisels were so noisy. And then he would come in periodically to check on my progress. The first project I worked on under him, I started with this 40-pound chunk of wood that I had cut out of a log, and I wasn't quite sure what I wanted to do with it. But, you know, this is art, so I thought I will just start carving on this thing, and I will let the log speak to me, and that'll just be wonderful. And so I started in working on this. And I got very intrigued with the grain and the texture of the wood around the top of it, so I started working with this, and this arch began to emerge out of this, and I was carving it, and I was smoothing it out, not paying much attention to the rest of it, but it was, I really kind of liked it, and it was growing out of this stump. And then Alan walked into the room, and as he usually did, he put my hammer in one hand and picked up a chisel with the other, and he stepped back and kind of looked at it pensively from one angle, and then at another, and then at a third. And then he walked up to it, and with one swing, smashed this little arch that I'd been carving. Splinters just flew all over the studio. And he stood back and looked at it pensively and looked at it from other angles. It was lying on its side now. The force of the blow had knocked the whole thing over. And he looked at it, and he seemed satisfied, so he turned around, and he handed the hammer and chisel back to me, and he walked out of the room. And he hadn't said a word. I deeply trusted Alan, and he knew that. I think that's why he thought he could get away with it. And when I got over the shock of his message, I really got at what he was saying, that I had gotten so absorbed in this little arch, which in the rest of the block was, I barely had the bark off it yet. And looking at it, it didn't really relate to anything else. So he quite literally smashed my attachment to it. And as soon as he did that, I could actually sit back and look at the whole thing, you know, in a whole and balanced way. I never finished that first project. Didn't quite know what I was doing anyway. But for the rest of the time, I was working with him. And then, you know, for years after that, I really got it, that you really have to pay attention to the whole of the thing. Otherwise, the whole thing is going to go out of whack and out of balance. It was a lesson that was just really immensely helpful for me. Another thing that I learned from him that I never heard of before until he spoke about it was the importance of negative space. Are you familiar with the concept of negative space? So if I was carving a statue of a person, for example, the positive space would be the torso and the arms and the material of the object, which everybody looks at. But in the negative space would be like the empty space, you know, between the arm and the torso, under the legs, or even the space that was outlined by the head and the neck and the torso. Most people, unless they're trained or familiar with this stuff, don't consciously pay attention to the negative space, but it's actually quite alive and has a texture and a feel and a tone, and it affects the aesthetic impact of the whole thing. So it's important. It was really important to be aware of it. Probably the most important single lesson that I learned from him, though, was about freeing the art. He spoke a lot about Michelangelo in this regard, and I still, to this day, I have these. I have this large book of photos. These really nice photos of Michelangelo's statues that I first studied when I was working with him, as well as a lot of his drawings. And Alan wanted me to copy his drawings to begin to learn some of his technique with the drawing and line control and stuff. Michelangelo was famous for saying that the sculpture, the piece of art, is already in the block before you start. And so the important thing is to see it and to know it and to free it. So his job was not to create it. It was just to clear away what was around it, to free the art, to come out where it could be seen. One evening I brought a fresh block of wood into my art lessons, to my sculpting lessons. Along with some drawings I had made of it was a man who was like crouching down like this, as I remember. This was a long time ago. And so Alan studied the block of wood, and he looked at my drawings, and then he turned to me, this cautious teenager that I was that tended to chip around the edges with my chisels. And he said to me, "You know, the first thing I want you to do with this is to show me this guy's navel." Because he said it's the deepest point inside the block, you know, as well as being the center. And he said, you know, if you can get that freed and exposed, you know, then the rest of it will come easily. And then he said to me, and I want you to go for it really quickly. Don't mess around with it. You know, if you need power drills and a chainsaw, you know, use those tools. Whatever it is that'll kind of free that and expose that stuff, just go for it. And that gave me the courage to actually sit back and really see this this piece in it, and then to know that if I wanted this thing to feel alive, then I had to get it as free as quickly as I could. And like I say, to this day, I really carry that with me. So just these four lessons that I found very, very important. In relating to myself, it was very important that I relate the same way Alan related to me. That is, with respect, with candor, you know, be really straight with myself, and kindness. The second thing was to pay attention to the whole of what I'm working with in a balanced way. The third is value in the negative space. And the fourth one was this business of really freeing what's inside the block and doing it as quickly as possible. So, now we'll see what this has to do with the jhanas. The term jhana, as the Buddha used it, really means stage. In some of the meditative traditions now, jhana refers to this one-pointed absorption. But if you read the text, and I'll read some of the text to you tomorrow, it's really clear he wasn't talking about a state of absorption. He was talking about a stage of meditative knowledge. And by meditative, it means something that you can only learn through direct experience. You can't learn it from books. You can't learn figure it out intellectually. It's something you have to experience directly in an embodied way. And as you're finding out, as many of you knew already, using the jhanas at some point becomes more of an art than a science. In the beginning, there are certainly a lot of details, and it can take some time to get it all sorted out. But as the practice goes deeper, the artistry in this whole practice really becomes paramount, extremely important. So tomorrow we'll look at the details, but tonight I just want to look at the whole of it in a broad way, and just applying these four lessons to the jhanas and to the art of meditation in general. So first of all, when we're working with the jhanas, it's important to relate to ourselves respectfully, candidly, not spinning things, but you know, really seeing things as they are and kindly. In the Satipatthana Sutta, so the foundation of mindfulness, which is the, I say it's almost like the holy grail of some of the Vipassana community. It's Majjhima Nikaya number 10. There are these lines where the Buddha says, "When a monk is restless, he knows he's restless. When he's not restless, he knows he's not restless. When he's filled with aversion, he knows he's filled with aversion. When he's not filled with aversion, he knows he's not filled with aversion. When he's deluded, he knows he's deluded. When he's not deluded, he knows he's not deluded." I always love that last one. How do you know when you're not deluded? There's actually one test. I mean, I think there are many ways, but one way you'll always know you're deluded is if you have a complaint. Right? A complaint says, if I were God and I'd made the universe, I would have done things differently. We'll play with that later. So you notice that the text doesn't say when he's restless, he knows his practice is hopeless. When he's free of aversion, he knows he's a great yogi. You know? When he's deluded, he gets up and gets something to eat. What it's saying in the text here is just he knows what's going on. He knows what's there and he knows what's not there. The implication of all this is that what's important in all this is that we just relate to our experience, again, with respect, with candor, and with kindness, without spin, just seeing what's there. One of the places where you can look at this is in your thoughts. You know, thoughts are a kind of an inner dialogue which in some ways reflect how we're relating to ourselves. And so it can be interesting at times just to pay attention, not to the content of your thoughts, but to the tone, to the tone of them. You know, are your thoughts respectful? You know, are they kind? Or do they have some kind of twist and pull and push? Okay. Number two. When we're working with the jhanas, it's really important to pay attention to the whole and the balance of the practice. To keep the whole of it in mind and in awareness. It's very easy to get caught up in non-essentials, to get up in little pieces. You know, if there's a part of the practice that we're really good at, you know, there can be this tendency to want to actually really focus in. You know, I like that. This works well for me, so I want to do this. Or sometimes people go the other way. I'm not very good at this, so I really need to really focus on that. When actually both of those are fine if they're approached in a balanced way, because we need, you know, the experience of working with what we're good at, because it helps to build confidence. And at the same time, it's important to work with what we're not so good at, because the learning that happens there can bring a lot of wisdom. So you have to pay attention to all this in a balanced way. This is from the Dhammapada, Sayings of the Buddha, verses 11 and 12. In the essential, we imagine, in the unessential, we imagine the essential. In the essential, we see the unessential. Anyone who entertains such wrong thoughts will never realize the truth. What is essential, what we regard as essential. What is unessential, we regard as unessential. Anyone who entertains such right thoughts will realize the truth. The only way that we can know what's essential and unessential, the way there's a hope, is really paying attention to the whole of the practice in this balanced way. Without that, it just gets distorted. And we can get caught up in little things, like me getting caught up in that little arch and miss the balance of it. Number three, in jhanas and in meditation, it is very important to pay attention to the negative spaces. Right? It's very important. Meditation is not about the clouds and the sky. It's about the sky within which those clouds float. Meditation is not about feelings, sensations, thoughts, memories that go through us. It's about the mind space and the quality of that mind space that holds all that. Meditation is not about the objects. It's not about the spiritual friend. It's not about the phrase. It's not about any of that. It's about the quality of the space within which we experience those. And if we never get our attention, I think I mentioned this the other day, I just can't emphasize this enough, if we never get our attention off the tangible objects and on to the meditation space, into the space of the mind, heart itself, the practice just will not go very far. It just can't. The mind, heart, everybody comfortable with that term? You know, in Pali, the language of the suttas, there is no distinction between mind and heart. That's a Western distinction. So the word sati, mindfulness, for example, could as easily be translated as heartful, as mindful. So to be mindful of something means to hold it in heart as well. So I'd like to use this term mind-heart to indicate that. The mind-heart doesn't have what Alfred North Whitehead called simple location. I think it's kind of a fun term. Simple location means that you can just locate it in time and space. You know, you can, the way you can touch your head or your hands or something like that. You can't touch the mind in the same way. It's in a sense, it's really an empty space. But without the space of the mind, we actually wouldn't know anything. You know, there would be no such thing as awareness. And just like in art, the mind space has texture, it has feeling, it has tone. The emptiness has an aliveness to it. It's a sense of aliveness. So the quality of the mind space has a profound effect on our experience, way beyond the content, way beyond the content. So in this practice, you know, what we're learning and practicing is releasing the tension in the mind-heart space. So it releases, so it can become less and less distorted. And because of the importance of this mind-heart space, the place where we begin is with working with these qualities of mind. You know, compassion, metta, kindness. And then in the beginning of the practice, we're actually cultivating more and more equanimity that comes out of all this in the early jhanas. And then the upper jhanas, they're actually just refining that. Number four. The most important aspect of the jhanas is actually knowing that the freedom that we're looking for is truly already here. It may be buried under layers of tension and distortion. We may not see it, we may not trust it, we may not know it, but it is really there. The liberation that we seek is already within us. It just needs to be freed. And there's really no other way to do this. The difference between physical arts like sculpting and meditative arts is in sculpting, you get a very clear image of what the art is inside the block. With us, in the meditation, we don't have a clear image of what that deep essence is. If we had a clear image of it, we'd be free. There'd be nothing left to do. But we don't have a clear image of it. Nevertheless, what we do is go in and start clearing stuff away. We're not creating anything. We're just clearing stuff away to see what emerges out of it. Does that make sense? I hope so. The Buddha's dying words would be a lamp unto yourself. It'll be the... we are the light that we seek. And in the beginning of the practice, it can feel like we're stumbling around in the dark a lot, you know, just looking for some modicum of illumination, something that'll show us a little bit of something. But as the practice goes deeper, we gradually discover, you know, a kind of a light that illuminates where we're going, see it more and more clearly. And then as the practice goes very deep, we realize that we are the light. And there's actually nothing hold of us. That's all there is. So in his dying words, the Buddha, I think, was encouraging us to trust the luminosity that can be found deep in the empty space of the mind-heart. So in... freeing the freedom one way to say what we're doing, and freeing the freedom that's already within us, is a little bit like sculpting in the sense that in the beginning we may use really heavy-duty equipment, power tools and chainsaws, like anything, to just to get some chunks of stuff out of the way, to clear some stuff out of the way. But as the practice goes deeper, we set down the power tools and we use maybe lighter chisels, and then as it goes deeper still, we're just using, you know, knives and sandpaper and very light things. So as the jhanas unfold, the practice gets lighter and lighter and lighter. However, if we started off with a feather duster to use as our tool on a block of maple, it would be very long, discouraging practice. So in the beginning, it's the real beauty of the jhanas, actually. The beauty of the jhanas is that they help us assess, you know, where we are. And if we need an air hammer, we use an air hammer. And as it gets lighter, if we just need a polishing cloth, then we use a polishing cloth. And then as it gets lighter and lighter and lighter, and there's more and more stripped away. It's sort of like the proverbial onion. And we strip away layer after layer after layer till you get to the core of it, which is nothing. As we were talking about last night, that's what nibbana is nothing. But we start out here with these cranes and steam shovels, and then we end up with this very light living emptiness. So tomorrow we'll kind of step back and go through the jhanas in detail. But if you just kind of get the sense of the whole of it, that's really probably the most important thing you need to know. The rest of it is just details. As we meditate as a community, there will be yogis around you. It's okay if I use the term yogi. You know, people talk about meditators, but I don't know, there's too many syllables in that. I would talk about students. But a yogi is someone who is really seriously engaged in a spiritual practice. And anybody who's willing for 10 days to get up at 5 in the morning and, you know, and fast 18 hours of the day and, you know, and sit still and go out and walk with the turkeys, definitely fits my definition of a yogi. Right? So in this, when we're in a community of yogis like this with people practicing, there will be people at all different places. Some people will be using air hammers. Other people will be using polishing cloths. Some people will be using, you know, spiritual friends, metaphrases. Other people will be using, you know, space and openness. And one of the traps that we can get into is thinking, oh, I'm going to practice like they're practicing. And the difficulty with my book, you know, is that I lay out a lot of these practices, and people come and say, oh, I really want to do this one. You know, I really like this one. And I don't know if I said this before, but just to say it bluntly, what you want is not relevant. Right? To gear our practice, or even to gear our lives off what we want, what we hope for, what we, you know, all that stuff isn't very skillful. The only thing that's important is what's true. And again, one of the beauties of the jhanas is that they give us a way of kind of assessing, you know, where we are and what's true about this place and the kind of tools that are most helpful for us. Because the next step you take in meditation can only be taken from where you are right now. You know, if you're right here and you want to take that step, there's just no way you can do it. The way you take that step is you have to take this one, and this one, and this one, and this one, and this one. And the fastest way to get there is actually to, you know, to take the next one. So, be kind and gentle and clear with yourself, and look for where that next step is. So let me pause at this point and just hear from you a little bit. Thoughts, comments, concerns, questions. What I want to do before we close is I'll take all this stuff and apply it to life out there, but let's sit here and see if this has touched anything.
Could you talk a little bit more about how to see the meditation practice as a whole?
Mm-hmm. Okay. So there are specific. So one of the ways of looking at the whole is actually beginning by just seeing clearly what your intentions are, what your motivations are in coming in. Because it's very easy to get caught into the details, like me, on that, and you get caught of that, and you lose the whole completely. But to come back, you know, and look at the whole of why it is that you're coming in, because that'll get you through a lot of difficulties. Because when you get caught up or it gets discouraging or something like that, that, you know, the question is, what am I doing this for anyway? And so, just to have a sense of that is really helpful. And then from that place of understanding your motivation is then looking deeply at whether it's wholesome. Okay, so in the Eightfold Path, you know, the first one is wise view, and then that gives rise to wise motivation. So if you have a sense of grasping, or something like that as part of your motivation. So I think the clearest motivations are really a sense of freedom, a sense of just seeing how things are, a way of opening up to whatever is, and actually kind of a trust that trust takes a while, but if it's there for you, that this can unfold in ways that may be helpful that you can't even imagine. So there's that a little sense of surrender to it. And then another part of seeing the whole of it is understanding the specifics of the techniques, with working with a spiritual friend or sending in all directions, and how that works. And to me, that's sort of the equivalent of like learning how to use the chisels. It's like the details of it. Like if you hold the chisel one way, it has a very different effect than if you turn it over and you do it the other side. So there is some stuff, as in any art, of actually building up the specific tools and then related back to what that has to do with the whole of it. Do people have other thoughts about how you keep the whole in balance? Yeah, so in terms of balancing the practice, then thank you that it's a matter of paying attention to the negative space. In my terms, pay attention to the quality of the thoughts, not just the content, not just the techniques, but the attitude, basically, with which you're looking at it. So there's this model I sort of mentioned briefly other day. There's clear awareness. There's whatever it is you're looking at, and you look through the space of the mind-heart, and so being aware of the qualities of that. So if there's tension in how you're looking at it, if there's striving, etc., that's going to distort it, and you're not going to be able to see the whole so easily.
Other thoughts about that or other questions?
What is the what between collectedness?
Difference
between collectedness and concentration?
I believe collectedness is the right way to go versus the focused concentration.
Yeah, so the word behind both of those is samadhi. And samadhi, we don't have any good English equivalent to it. The closest translation of I've heard, the one that I like the most is calm abiding. And in calm abiding, it's described as the attitude with which a mother looks at her sleeping child. So, if you sort of imagine that, there's a space that's actually wide open and soft and receptive, but it's actually quite collected. You know, so concentration comes from the sense that that the field of awareness is quite unified. When the samadhi is strong, the field awareness feels very simple. The difficulty with the word concentration is that in English, it implies a lot of effort. Think of a conductor, you know, concentrating. It's a tremendous amount. And that won't work so well. The collectedness helps get at the quality of this unified mind, and collectiveness has a much softer, you know, sense to it. The word itself, just the sound of it, is not too helpful for me. But in meditation, I've actually found the sense of looking at, is my mind hard? Is it collected or uncollected now? Is actually a very, very helpful. For me, it's been a very helpful reference. So collectedness is Bhante Vimalaramsi's translation of samadhi.
So if you have a personal wish to attain peace, and equanimity and release tanha, you have, one needs to be careful and mindful of not having that be a grasping thing.
Yes. It's the difference. I've got a chair over here for you. This is Erica. We've been married 45 years, which seems like a long time to me. I don't know. The essence of the difference between a wholesome and an unwholesome desire is wisdom. And the essence of wisdom is seeing causation. It's dependent origination. So a wholesome desire is one that says, okay, if I'm more peaceful, if I'm more compassionate, and so forth, my life will be better, it would be healthier. And so from wisdom, it looks at what are the causes and conditions that would give more wisdom, more collectedness, more compassion. And then it tries to set up those conditions. Okay. And if it works, that's great. And if it doesn't work, that's great too, because, you know, like a good scientist, you know, a negative result says, okay, so we need to do something different and sort of experiment with it. Desire, in the sense of tanha, has a grasping quality, and it tries to grab hold of the compassion, grab hold of the peace. It goes right for the results. And so it has that tension in it. So the wholesome desires are called chanda, and the unwholesome are called tanha. And there are lots of different words for desire in Pali. But that's the basic difference between them. And, you know, without some motivation, we wouldn't move into this all. So there's actually some seeking. And I think I used the example the other night of the burning ghats in Varanasi, and that that even with the chanda, even with the wholesome motivations, eventually those have to go too. Those have to be burned up with the rest. But they can carry us quite a long way. I talked about that, right? There's a funeral pyre, and they have a stick to stir the fire, and you throw the stick in at the end. That's what those wholesome ones are like.
Doug, you mentioned you were talking about qualities you wanted to get rid of, and you mentioned being good friends with them.
That's right.
Best friends with them.
Well, maybe not best friends, but good friends. So what do I mean by that? You know, is that thing I was saying the other night about you get what you put your energy into? So if you don't like something and you put your energy in to get rid of it, it actually strengthens it. At least in the mind space, that's how it works. But if there's this friendly attitude towards it, and you get to know it, I have, despite my years of depression, even in the midst of that, I still had an optimism that sometimes almost look Pollyannish. But so when I look at these unwholesome qualities, my basic view of them is that they really want the best for us. You know, fear is trying to protect us. Anger is trying to keep, you know, some painful thing off, or is trying to break through, you know, somebody's thing so we can make a good connection with them. You know, whininess, you know, is trying to say, you know, I'm really hurting here. You know, is there anything that can help? You know, the difficulty with those unwholesome qualities is not what their intentions are, but that they're just not very wise in how they go about it. So the sense of making friends with them is just recognize them for what they are, so you can actually relax and just let them be. And I think all of us have at least 24 different personalities, right, that show up in different situations. The difference between us and a clinical multiple personalities, we don't have amnesia. So one of my persona is this kind of, you know, very efficient kind of businessman that kind of, you know, wants to focus down and get things done, et cetera, et cetera. And I can remember late afternoons working in one of the churches that I was at. It was always kind of finishing up the business, and so this persona was out there getting this stuff done. And then I would come home, and my kids were quite young, and they would greet me at the door. And this efficient businessman was not the best one to work with, you know. So I could treat it as the enemy then and get rid of it, or just realize, okay, this is just what it likes to do, and sort of, you know, almost in my imagination, send him off to go to something it liked to do, and then free up for, you know, the playful side of me that could be with my kids. So business of not getting caught in a dualistic relationship, even with the negative qualities. I learned a long time ago, working as a therapist, that if I did not love my clients in some really kind of true, essential way, I would be no good to them. Didn't mean I had to like them. And part of that... And the great thing with working about clients is it may be somebody that, you know, if I met them in the grocery store, it would drive me up the wall. But, you know, within a therapeutic setting, there was a way where I could see into the essence of what their stuff were and what they were doing and how whatever their feelings or behaviors were serving some sort of positive end, that was the intention behind them. And once I could see that, then I could, in that friendly way, then I could relate to him, including being very fierce with him, because I saw the essence, you know, that essence. So making friends with the difficult qualities in us has a lot of that sense. And in this practice, you know, the 6 hours are never about getting rid of anything. They're absolutely not. They're just about relaxing the tension in it. The difficulty with the 6 hours is that they are very efficient sometimes at getting rid of that stuff, because once the tension goes out of it, then they dissolve. And then we think, ah, okay, now I'm going to use it to get rid of the next one. But it doesn't work.
I wonder if you could just go back to the samadhi and collectedness piece.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm sure there's people in this room who've done samadhi or concentration meditation.
Mm-hmm.
And that has a certain kind of result. And using what we call collectedness, this expansive type of awareness, has another type. Do you know, could you tell just, you know, so people know the difference.
Sure.
And the results. While the goal might be the same, the results are different.
Yeah. So the essence of the difference is that in one-pointed concentration, you're trying to get the... thanks for the prop. He's my straight man. is in one-pointed concentration, what you're doing is getting all the attention down onto... to one point. In this practice, we're actually trying to cultivate a 360-degree field of awareness that sees everything. Because what frees us is actually seeing how the mind-heart works. So, the good example, best example I know of the limitations of one-pointedness is actually hypnosis. You know the techniques of hypnosis, you get somebody to focus down onto one object and one object alone, and if they get absorbed enough in it, they go into this hypnotic trance in which you can say to them, "You're a chicken." And they go, "What? What? What?" You know. So the difficulty with one point of concentration is that your wisdom and your intelligence goes offline because it gets so pointed. You know, with just the slightest little bit of breadth of field, you know that you're not a bird. But when it gets down that, all that stuff goes offline, and we actually become quite gullible. I was listening to Utejaniya once, and this woman was talking about how when she was meditating, she kept on finding herself leaning over further and further, and her back was hurting. She asked him if there's anything that he could do to help, and she said, "You're becoming one-pointed. You know that your attention is getting focused down on one thing to the point that you're actually no longer aware of your body and not even aware that it's hurting." And she says, "You have to open the field up." And so that's really the most important aspect of it. When I was in Thailand, it was very much a one-pointed practice up to a certain point. And then we went into this period of time where for, it was usually 3 days, but it could be 4 or 5, where you did nothing but meditate without sleeping, just around the clock. And so the practice up to that point had been this intense focusing. I think there were 26 points on the body, so you're focusing on one and return and just... Well, after 24 hours of not sleeping, sometimes my mind would get very, very quiet, but I just didn't have the energy to focus it in tightly. And so the field of awareness just got softer and more open. It was very, very, very collected. And then I started to, slip into in and out of nibbana. So you can use one-pointed concentration to develop that and then undo the whole thing and open out in that soft, open awareness.
So there are lots of different techniques. So I think there are people that can use one point in concentration and get there. But I just find this way of cultivating this wide open field from the beginning. First of all, it's a lot easier on the body. And it doesn't take as much drama. And it's, in at least in my experience, it's a little more effective to carry it back out in the world than if the only way you know how to get into, a deep, steady, wide open place is to not sleep for 3 days after concentrating intensely for 10.
Because really, using concentration decondition the habitual tendencies, or in this case, the hindrances. Temporarily, while it's in effect, it could suppress it.
It suppresses it. The deconditioning can happen, but the deconditioning takes a long time. But in the short run, it does suppress them. I think I was saying before, I think of it as like holding a beach ball underwater. You know, you can actually get all the... And if the hindrances are gone, the mind becomes actually quite luminous and clear and spacious and quite lovely. But it's like holding beach balls underwater. As soon as you relax, they come up with a vengeance. And that's what happened to me in Thailand a lot, too. I would get into these deep, deep states, and then I would come out of it. And I gave that quote from my journal. Was actually, I had gone into Nibbana and then come out, and 3 hours later, it felt like my mind had checked every other book out of the Library of Congress, and it was reading them all at once. And I asked Ajahn Tong, I said, so why are we doing this? And what he said was, he was talking about a Thai vegetable, which I think they prepare it sort of like we do kale. You take the stem, and you put your hands around the stem, and then you pull it through, and you pull all the leaves off. And he said, that's what this practice, as he was teaching it, does. It strips everything off, all the defilements off, in their pure state, and then the leaves grow back. And then you strip them again, and they grow back, and you keep on stripping. And you can see over a long period of time how that would gradually work your way down, into that. But again, I just find this approach a lot more efficient. And it's the one the Buddha taught. And I just think he was a genius. Not only just for the depth of his practice, but just as a teacher. I mean, if he was teaching mathematics, that probably would have been a genius, too. He just had this way of kind of sensing and figuring out what was essential and unessential and just, get down to it. And my experience with this practice is just that.
Would it be appropriate at this time to ask you what you would suggest to people to retain what they get from this treat over time afterwards, or is that going to be dealt with in a different presentation?
Yeah, we're going to deal with that... was that Tuesday morning during the social hour? Was that? we can talk. I'd rather wait till a little long because that we have enough trouble getting here. We don't have to start worrying about leaving so soon. This practice carries out very easily, though.
Would it be fair to ask you to characterize the vipassana? What falls entailed in that? Rest of it, just by way of comparison. The reason I ask is because my son went to one this year and recommended that I go, and I came here instead. So,
okay.
Just for reference, if there's some way to think.
The answer is no, it's not a fair question. but I'll deal with it anyway. What's not fair about it is that Vipassana actually means a lot of different things. This is a Vipassana practice. Vipassana just means insight. And so so the core of it is actually creating the inner conditions in which insight is most likely to arise. That's actually the essence of it. Where the variations come in and how these techniques and stuff are used. There is, I call it SAVE, S-A-V, Standard American Vipassana, which has a particular approach. which is to develop one-pointed concentration. And then when the mind gets steady enough, it softens and goes out into a choiceless awareness. And then there's a little bit of metta that's sprinkled around the edges. Those are the essential elements. And how a lot of it is taught has... I don't think has a lot that's at odds with this in its essence. What I've found here, though, is that... So, for example, most Vipassana teachers will talk a lot about the importance of relaxation and ease and openness, etc. Even though they teach the one point of concentration, what I didn't find in it is actually how you actually do the relaxation in the context of the guts of the practice. So it wasn't tightly so it was recognized. So I would be. In my early training, they would say it's important not to try too hard. So I would try very hard not to try too hard. But I didn't know quite how to do that, and it was falling back. This one has, many more, power drills and chainsaws, right up at the beginning to get it there. One of the other differences between this practice and... in standard American Vipassana, is actually this use of the jhanas, which is this map that's been laid out. There was a tendency in my early training, and it's been a while since I've been to a standard American Vipassana retreat, so I can't speak from current knowledge. I just lost my train of thought.
That's because Grant walked in.
Oh, so Grant's the one who's going to keep us all focused. Welcome. We got a chair for you right here. I haven't been married to Grant for 45 years. Erica just came in too, so welcome, welcome, welcome. Yeah, and I was trying to remember why that was important. So I'm not sure how they do it now, but I never heard much use of the jhanas. And the jhanas are really the Buddha's map. And the Majjhima Nikaya has 152 suttas, and 67 of them refer to the jhanas. And the breath meditation is referred to in about 10 places. So I don't know if it's a fair measure, but it seems like the Buddha thought the jhanas were at least 6 times more important than the breath awareness, because they give this map of how to work with the core stuff and with some amount of discipline that may be needed in the beginning, and then how to really back out of that as you move along. I know what I was going to say. That in the most of the retreats I went to, there was a sense of one size fits all. So there's one practice that everybody was doing. And in this one, it actually changes. So as the process deepens, this practice takes advantage of that and then tweaks it to go along. Did I mention here earlier? I got an email from an old friend as I was going into retreat at Bhante's, and she had been talking about how she had been using a metta practice, and basically it was the way it's taught in the standard American Vipassana community, and found it really, really helpful. And then a year later, she just found it really annoying. And actually, when I was in Reno, there was somebody there who had done a lot of that and just found it really great. And then after a while, they just found it really kind of cumbersome. And it was because there was one practice that fit everything, rather than with this practice as as you know, that as it goes a little deeper, you know, we tweak it, you know, we change it to take advantage of that. So she was doing a practice of actually holding her back rather than pushing her on. So the Vipassana community, in my experience, doesn't have as much of refined awareness of how to actually employ that. And there are a lot of teachers that actually know a lot about the jhanas but don't necessarily use them. You know, my root teacher, who I still love and visit with often, understands the jhanas a lot, but it actually doesn't teach them. And he saw me go into the jhanas, so we looked around and find Bhante, and he sent me to him. So, I just want to be a little careful about not trying to set up too much of a us and them business, of an us and them business. Some of the people who are reading the early draft of Buddha's Map said that that I needed to make clear the distinction between this practice and standard and the Vipassana practice that people are familiar with. And I actually didn't want to do that, so I wrote a chapter in the end which was actually trying to build the bridges between one practice and the other. I do find this has been the most effective thing by far, but I just don't want to get into an us and them.
I have a question on the back to the art of meditation.
Mm-hmm.
On the mechanics part.
Oh, that's right. That was my topic tonight. Thank you for remembering.
On the mechanics part of it, so on the sitting straight and sitting still.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
That's why I mentioned the art of...
Okay. That's a great example, because it is an art. So on the one hand, when you want to move, it's usually from an unwholesome state, right? You're uncomfortable. I don't like it. I want to get out of this. And so what can happen if you hold still... and you work with the six R's, is you actually work through those unwholesome qualities. So sitting still without moving can be a tremendous help. On the other hand, there are some times when discomfort comes up and you do everything you can to open up to it and see it in a wholesome way, and there's something about your system that just can't handle it. You know, and locks up, and despite yourself, there's something that's digging in the heels and fighting it. Well, to work with the urge to move, you know, out of a place that's just straining all over the place is not a helpful state to be in. And so in those situations, you're better off moving and doing something to break that. So there's a couple of different ways you can do that. One is to just get up, you know, and go into walking meditation. Usually, if you do small adjustments, that works really good for 2 or 3 minutes, you know, and then, you know. And that's why, you know, a lot of the advice in this is to hold, you know, really still. And if you have to move, just get up and move into walking meditation, because if you try to cheat it and stuff, it'll just proliferate. The one thing I would warn people on to never do, is if you get a little tickle. Like I would get this sensation sometimes, it feels like there's somebody has one hair and they're pressing it against my cheek and then turning it. You know, very little sensation, but you know, it's like this. And so you just go like that and it goes away. And my experience is that within about 30 seconds, there will be two over here. And then there are four here and they just... And I don't know what it is. I thought it was just me. And then I'm quoting Utejni all the time. I heard him say this once. Apparently, it's, you know, that happens to a lot of people. So those little tiny ones that are not actually great pain, but are just irritation, those are ones that are really good to 6R. And I find with those tickles, you know, if you really just keep 6R in it, they don't last but more than 2 or 3 or 4 minutes, you know, and then they're gone. So the other place where I would say moving is okay, you know, to do those shorter adjustments, is if you were sitting for very long periods of time. I sometimes use the example of that sometimes, you know, I'll get there's a fold in my pants leg and I don't notice it. But after an hour and a half or 2 hours, it's like cutting into my skin. And if I go like this and straighten it out, then it goes away. Well, when I make that movement, it will disturb the equanimity. But, you know, if I'm already in a fairly quiet state, that disturbance will last a minute or two. And then I'm right back in and may be able to go for another hour or so. So this is actually where the art is actually you have to try some stuff, and I would push the limits of it a little bit each way, you know, so maybe sit a little bit still to the point that you realize, you know, it just goes out of balance, you know, that's too far, so you can come back a little bit from that. And, you know, you can try all kinds of things to find out where that place that just helps you settle. So what the art of it is knowing how much of a disturbance or a movement that the benefit of it outweighs the difficulties of it. And it's really hard to say, and it's different for different people. Another thing you can do if it gets restless is you can just stand up and meditate standing up. It's actually really good for sleepiness, too. I remember seeing somebody fall asleep standing up. And it's not just because of the rigidity of it, but because, you know, we never actually stand still. So when you're standing there, the body is always making these just very small muscular adjustments, you know, to keep you in balance and stuff. And that's actually enough to put a little energy in the system to wake you up a little bit. It means you burn the energy through a little bit more quickly, but, you know, that sometimes it's a way to stay awake. So, should I take us out into the rest of life, or we have more?
I have just a kale question.
You have a what question?
A kale question.
Kale.
Do you strip the leaf off when it's still on the plant, and it's still on the ground, and then it regrows the leaf? Did you say that?
I didn't say that. What I said was exactly what Ajahn Tong said to me through a translator. He didn't say that the leaves and the plant actually grow back. He said when we strip the defilements off us, then they grow back, and you strip them off. Yeah, and you keep on stripping them.
The other kale's much more magical.
Yeah. And this wasn't kale. You know, if you've ever been in Thailand, they have vegetables there. Yeah, it's a whole different flora there. You know, it's like there's some of the stuff I had never seen anything like it. And not speaking the language, I didn't know what I was eating. So, if art...
don't know all the people who benefited out there from this practice or this other practice.
Did you have a specific, or was it, just the general? Okay. Yeah, there are lots and lots of practices, and I also think that sometimes those of us who are teaching this fool ourselves and think that my technique works really well. What happens is if somebody comes in who's just ripe, you know, I could say, you know, let's play, you know, break bottles in the corner, and that would be enough from the wake up because they're just so primed. So there's a practice, and then there's the yogi, and there's the mixture between the two of them. And it's the only little caveat I would put on that, and this is I want to completely honor what you say, and. You know, there's this metaphor about there are many roads up the mountain, and that you come from all kinds of different angles, and they look at different places and stuff. And the only thing I would add to that is that not all roads go to the top. And sometimes you don't really know. And so I ended up in this practice. I was always looking for one that had track record. You know, and I started, I don't know how many years ago, but I didn't want to practice that someone had invented in the 60s. I wanted something that had been around for a long time and gone through lots of different people and cultures, et cetera, that had been vetted. That's why I ended up with a Buddhist practice after doing, I mean, I did all kinds of stuff. Sufi, I spent a lot of time with Ram Dass. It's all over the place. And what you're saying is actually, there's a couple places where the Buddha talks about instructions and teachings. And one of the things he says is don't ever speak ill of someone else's practice. Because it does set up all these dichotomies and stuff, and you just don't know.
It's not right or wrong, bad or good. It's about where each of us are, but we're ready here.
Mm-hmm.
I don't think I would have got the jumps before now, but I'm excited about it at this point.
Yeah.
So, and, you know, I also listen to Tibetan Buddhists, depend on who they are, really.
Right. There was a study that was done in Chicago back in the 60s that was actually studying different styles of psychotherapy. And the question was to figure out which one was most effective. You know, and then there was the Freudian, and then there was the behaviorist, and then there was the humanistic psychology that was coming out, Carl Rogers and Fritz Perls and those guys. And the interesting thing about the study was that what they found was that the style of psychotherapy didn't make that much difference. If there was something in the interaction of the person with the teacher that helped the client feel directly what was going on, it seemed to be effective. And I think there's, you know, that the meditation is quite similar to that. That there can be a chemistry between, you know, the teacher and the student, and there can be a chemistry between the various styles and the personality of the person coming in and what they need. And there can be lots of different ways to go at this. And... postmodern pluralism, which is the center of gravity of most Buddhist sanghas I know. Probably their theme song is "Everything is beautiful in its own way," you know, and that's a very important perspective. And some things are more effective than others. And so we don't want to fall into the trap of saying, you know, everything's the same, everything can get you there. Or fall into the trap of saying, my God's better than your God. There is some place in the mixture of all that, which is actually the art of this. Wasn't that a neat segue I just did? Did you notice that? Okay. Anything more? Should I talk a little bit about this out in larger life, just while I have these four things here? Okay. So, if we want to live lives that are robust and peaceful, and it's very important to learn to relate to ourselves. This is number one. It's very important to relate to ourselves with this respect, candor, and kindness. And I mentioned, you know, a little bit about paying attention to the dialogue in your head. It's a way we talk with ourselves. And if that dialogue is harsh or critical or would inflate or deflate your ego, then there is a certain amount of tension in it. And you just want to 6R it. If we want to live in a life that's whole and balanced, then in our life out there, it's important to pay attention to our work, our play, our service to the world, our all the various different aspects of our life, and to keep those, in balance. That there's a trap that we can get caught in some aspect of our life that we really like, and really kind of perfect that, and ignore other parts of our life. And if that happens, it doesn't matter how much genius we have in that one area, our life is going to be distorted. Well, I'll give this little example. I don't know. Maybe it's because my wife walked in. She's a pianist. But I think of the difference between... I'll just say it. Van Cliburn as a musician. And do any of you know Peter Serkin? So Van Cliburn... is an incredibly technical, virtuoso pianist. And when I listen to his playing, it doesn't feel like he has much soul, much to say. He's technically perfect. Peter Serkin's father, Rudolf Serkin, was a world-class pianist. I mean, just really sweet, wonderful man. And his father... When Peter Serkin was about 14, had his debut in Carnegie Hall, and then his father pulled him out of the public life until his late 20s, I think, before he let him emerge. So he developed as a whole person. And so when he finally came back on the music scene, he was an incredibly fine pianist, and you could just feel in him that he had this whole, this richness that came through the music that I could never hear in Van Cliburn. So no matter what the area of our life that we really like the most, to keep them all developed in a balanced way is really, really important. If we want to live lives that are filled with well-being, we have to really pay attention to the negative spaces. What we don't do can sometimes have just as much impact as what we do. You know, what we don't say can have as much impact as what we do say. How we rest can be just as important as how we produce. So those negative spaces are very important. And if we want to live lives of spiritual freedom, I just think it really helps. It really helps to trust that there is a unique and liberated being, unique and already liberated being within us. The spiritual path is not about transforming us from a lump of mud, into a Buddha. you know, from a dullard into an exemplar, from a demon into an angel, just refer back to the other night. It's really about finding some ways of getting out of the way to allow that unique liberated being to come free. Did I tell you about Larry Rosenberg? He's the guiding teacher at Cambridge Insight Center, and he says, you know, everybody's trying to get from A to Z, and I'm just trying to get from A to A. Well, I was thinking about him, and I just love that statement of his, and to steal it from him and to twist it a little bit, it's like everybody's trying to get from 1 to 100, and what we're really trying to do in our lives is basically get from 1 to 0. Chris Christopherson, he had this song he wrote, love the line, he said, freedom's just another word for nothing left to lose. And it's when we really have nothing left to lose, that's when we're really free. That's when we're really free. So, namaste. It's been wonderful sitting in the interviews with you guys. I feel like I have this ringside seat as watching people unfold. And it becomes very clear to me that, you know, what I do is a part of it, but a small part. But what you bring and your practice is inspiring to watch. And I know it doesn't feel that way all the time when you're slogging through it, but as I watch it unfold, it feels like a really privilege to watch this unfold. So I'm very grateful for all of your practice. And let us, if there's been anything of value in your practice today, this week, this evening, let's just take the value, the clarity, the sense of life, freedom, love, and that, and just feel our connection to one another here, and then as a collective body, just send that out to the birds that are out there right now, to the turkeys, to the other people on the grounds, out to the people and creatures around this part of the valley, out to the coast, out across the whole planet. May all beings know joy. May all beings know balance and wholeness. May all beings be attuned to the negative spaces, the emptiness, and the texture within that. May all beings relate to themselves with love and respect and candor and clarity. May all beings know that there is a freedom that can only be found when they get out of the way. May all beings be free. May all beings have sweet dreams. Namaste.